We've had a few living legends from the world of cycling on the podcast over the years, and today I'm delighted to be adding another one to that glittering roster. Gary Fisher is one of the founding fathers of mountain biking. His life in, and sometimes out, of cycling is the subject of a fabulous new book called Being Gary Fisher. And as well as an interview with Gary, I'm delighted to be joined by two of the people who made that book happen. Longtime friend of the podcast, Guy Andrews, who published the book, and Guy Kesteven, who helped Gary convert his swirling Technicolor galaxy of thoughts and recollections into a linear sequence of letters and spaces known as words, sentences, and paragraphs. Welcome, both of you, to the podcast.
Hi, Jack. Thanks for having us on.
Hi, Jack.
I'm going to assume that a lot of the people listening to the podcast don't know who Gary Fisher is, or may have heard the name or seen it on a bike or two, but don't really know much more than that. So before we hear from Gary in my interview with him, can we take a moment to fill those people in the briefest terms? And this is going to be a real challenge for you in sort of boiling it down, on the part that Gary Fisher played in the genesis of mountain biking, and also why you were so keen to work with him on the book.
Oh, crikey, that's such a difficult one to answer quickly. I think the one thing I'll say is I think it's Gary's personality and ability to tell the story, I guess, was the bit that was exciting from a book publishing point of view. And also, you know, he's such a colourful character. I mean, that in the kind of the broadest sense of the term, because what I think he's done is he actually turned cycling on its head. He was from a traditional, if you like, cycling background, but his life took a lot of series of twists and turns. And as it happened, he brought to cycling was just a slightly new way of looking at it. And I think that's the unique part of the story. And I think that's the unique part of Gary Fisher is that his ability to get across his passion for not just cycle sport, but for cycling as a lifestyle, I guess, for want of a better word. I think that's the thing that stands him as probably the biggest name in the cycling business from that point of view. He just has this incredible ability to tell a story, which we explain in the book. It's a lifetime achievement, if you like, a lifetime's work to get to that point.
So Guy Kesteven, it's going to fall to you, I'm afraid, to fill us in on some of the basic facts of who is Gary Fisher and why does Gary Fisher matter?
Well, for a start, he was the guy who coined the phrase mountain bikes. That was the sign above the shop he set up in the late 70s in California, and he failed to patent it. That's another long story. But he was the guy who coined the phrase mountain bikes. Before that, they were clunkers or they were woodsy bikes. And that's kind of an extrapolation right through. He was the guy who made mountain biking a marketable sport and recreation. And he was the guy who really pushed it from an experiential side. And as in his own words, sold the shit out of it. Not just locally, but globally. And, you know, he went from, you know, the early mountain bikes were more expensive. Twice the price of a top-of-the-range Coronado at the time. And he made not just mountain bikes, but bikes as a whole, really, really aspirational. So not only did he invent a sport that kind of captured the extreme, sort of the growing extreme sports scene of that day, but he also made it the kind of thing that you wanted in the back of pictures in flats on TV programs if you're trying to do aspirational stuff there. You know, it became a real lifestyle accessory, something that cycling had never been before. Up to that point, bikes had been something that you only used if you couldn't drive a car or if you wanted to portray someone as a bit down on their luck. And all of a sudden, you know, it was what you stuck on top of your fancy car. It was something you did and showed off about doing. It wasn't something you kind of hid as a dirty secret. You know, it was properly revolutionary on that level, what he did with the mountain bike. You know, he's gone from a tiny little backwater sport to being on the front of Time magazine, to being, you know, a multi-million selling lifestyle magazines across the globe. And he's pretty much the guy, he's the prime mover behind all of that.
Well, thank you both. And I think it's time to hear from Gary himself. And after my chat with Gary, I want to come back to you and add a bit of context and your own reflections, as there was so much about the story that I wasn't able to cover in the time that I did have with Gary. So I began at the beginning and asked Gary to cast his own mind back to the moment when he first fell in love with cycling.
It was like when I was like 10 and 11, and I had some local friends, and I had a Raleigh Colt 3-speed, and we would fly around town, and it was our freedom out of our little small block. We could go all over the neighborhood, and with my two best friends at the time, that was it. You know, that was the beginning. And you know, I still have those feelings. I still be able to get it. You know, it's a miracle. We can have so much fun in under 20 miles an hour.
And so on the one hand, I suppose that could be a rational thing, you know, freedom for a child under their own power to go and do what they want with their friends, to get out from beneath the eyes of parents and carers and that kind of thing. And that's part of it. But is there a, I guess you might call it a kinesthetic side of it, the side of it that is felt in your body and in the way in which your body interacts with your mind, that is a world of sensations. But can you put that into words?
Well, my wife will say to me, you're getting twitchy. I think you should go on a bike ride. And it helps you forget, and it helps you remember. That's what it does. And we know this. And now we have more medical peer-reviewed papers that tell us that there's a lot of reasons, you know, besides just the endorphins and, you know, the physicality, that the fitness and everything is this movement that we make. We go from side to side. Skater does it. Surfer does it. Bike rider does it. It actually makes us happy. And I'm a great believer that this world could use a lot more happiness.
Something that I experience with people who have not ridden a bike for a long time is when they get on a bike, it just makes them smile, and they rekindle quite a lot of sensations and ideas that they thought they'd left behind in childhood. It kind of makes us young again in mind, if not in body.
Well, that's the biggest disease of all, right? It's like losing your childhood, losing that sort of like curiosity, that happiness, you know, the spontaneousness, you know. Man, we die in stages, you know? And that's, I just, it's so evident.
So let's turn back to those early days. What was the status of the bicycle in 1950s America? What did the bicycle signify?
Well, it got very close to disappearing. You know, there were 1966 was the first national road race they had in over 30 years. Bike racing was mostly on the track. And it existed in the East Coast and the Midwest, and it just about died, you know, completely in California. And it was, you know, the whole 1955 was when they started building the interstate freeway system. And it was the most money that the United States ever spent, you know, and hasn't spent anywhere near that much money on any type of project. And it was based on a fantasy, you know, more than anything, and a great idea in a way that didn't work out the way people figured out, you know, and had no facility for bicycle riders or pedestrians. And the vision of the future in the United States was going to be 100% motorized.
And so bicycles were seen as something from the past?
Well, from the past, for kids or for a DUI victim, you know, a real loser.
So to fall in love with the bicycle at that age that you were at, 10, 11, was to go against the grain of society?
Yeah. You would see a bike rider riding at that time, and like you either knew exactly who they were, or you stopped, you know, exchanged phone numbers, or like they were a kid or a DUI victim like that. They were just, it was like, that's how few bike riders there were in the San Francisco Bay Area and in all of the United States.
And was there anything that you could say that within that, those kind of people that, that was common between them, some a common thread, or was everyone different and freakish in their own way?
Well, they were a lot of different and freakish in their own ways, but they were like, they're all like used to being outlaws. I mean, definitely. It's really funny. And, you know, like we'd ride down in San Mateo County, and when I was like 13, 14, and we'd ride through La Honda. It'd be an 80-mile ride, and we'd see the Hells Angels out there, you know, and they'd look at us, and we'd look at them, and we'd both nod. We were outlaws, you know, two-wheel outlaws, you know. They always gave us respect, you know. That's funny. And so you felt like that. You know, you definitely – but the bike riders were bold, you know, in that they didn't care. They walk into a restaurant with their jerseys or stuff on. You don't understand it, that's fine. It's okay. And there wasn't any conflict that I remember except for the police. I mean, I got stopped. I was a kid. You know, I get stopped by the cops sometimes. What are you doing out here? You're supposed to ride on the sidewalk. You can't be in the road. You know, that's ridiculous. You can't ride on the sidewalk and make mileage or anything. You know, and the cops would make me cry and I want to go home and all this, you know, oh, it's horrible, you know, but that was the only thing. There wasn't as much car traffic. You know, the people didn't go out there in those places as much. So it was really light traffic, and it was just like a miracle that, you know, we could, I'd ride 80 miles on the Sunday ride when I was like 14, and that was normal, you know, and club riding. It was just so much fun. I couldn't imagine not doing it ever.
It seems like a very abrupt turn from this kid who was going to races, riding out, doing these big rides and the empty roads of Northern California, and suddenly you're in the thick of 1960s counterculture, doing light shows for the Grateful Dead, the Haight-Ashbury scene, the whole thing. There are a lot of people who say, I was there, but you were really there.
I was, you know, it's like Jack Leary, Timothy's son, he was my best friend, you know. I worked for the Bear, who's a guy who made more LSD than anybody in the world. And, you know, I still stayed in touch with him until he passed a few years ago, you know. And like Ken Kesey, he used to hang out on his farm and talk with him. I was a kid, you know. I built a geodesic dome with him one time, you know, and they were like, they're all like famous people. Mountain Girl, oh my God. She's, you know, Garcia, Jerry Garcia. Garcia taught me how to roll the J, man. You know, how to clean the weed, the whole thing as a kid. Like 15, I met Jerry, and I'd hang out. I go with Jerry a lot. I go to his house, and Jerry said to me, you know, and Mountain Girl, his girlfriend, there was all kinds of stuff. You know, I was really good friends with the manager, really Grateful Dead, John McIntyre, for a long time. Bobby Weir, you know, we went on a, like a 10-day trip one time up to Montana, mountain biking, fighting clear cutting with, oh man, with John Oates from Hall and Oates, mountain biking and everything. That was like in the 80s, and the critical part was there in the 60s. There was a lot of great brains there. You know, it's like people thinking about consciousness expansion and about society improvement and what could happen and all that. And it was incredibly exciting times because it was like some big change and everything. You know, it just... There was the Vietnam War and all that. I mean, and people were protesting being shipped off to this place and killing people that they had no reason to kill. You know, it's crazy times, you know, and we had that sitting as a kid. You had that sitting on your chest as like you could be drafted and sent off the next year around the San Francisco Bay Area with all my friends. Everybody was figuring out a way to get out of it because it was like, you know, you could be called up. And then it was like the whole nuclear threat too. I mean, we were told, you know, yeah, get under your chairs and your desks at school bend over really hard and kiss your ass goodbye. You had that type of pressure, and that created a lot of change, you know, in people. And it's the same like what we've been going through this last, you know, it's not over yet situation. And this is, to me, it's hilarious because it goes right back to like LSD was a very like interesting drug in that it was like micrograms is what you would take. And that's like, that's the tiny, tiny amount. You know, and back then you'd take 50, 100 micrograms, and now it's come back, you know, it's sort of like in Silicon Valley, they're doing that, but they'll do 10 micrograms, which is much more reasonable. I mean, we did things way too much to excess. There's no doubt. And then came in, you know, really some like cocaine. That stuff is not good for an organized brain. It creates a very disorganized brain.
So I have this picture of bike racing, cycling and kind of parties, concerts, happenings, acid, like fighting over your soul. And like, are you going in and out? Are you managing both at the same time? What's happening? How's it working?
Oh, as a kid, I wanted to do a light show too, because that was communication, you know, and was like, and the big communicator at the time was radio for the bands and everything. They'd get exposure on radio like crazy. And light shows, well, I came to the realization that like, we're not going to get on the network television. There's no such thing as video at the time. You know, it wasn't a thing. There isn't what there is today. And, you know, you became sort of like a pawn. You needed to work for a rock band. And that's not really where I wanted to go on the whole thing. And there were 50 light shows in the San Francisco Bay Area. And a lot of them were willing to do the show for $50 a night. And we'd burn $100 worth of bulbs a night in 60s money. You know, it was crazy. We had 10 people on the show. This was a big deal. You know, we couldn't operate in those sort of margins and that sort of a thing. And the biggest promoter in the Bay Area, Bill Graham, he like said, I hate all you light show guys. I'm going to pay you $100 a night. And what he did, the trick he did is he had a passageway. It went from the light show booth. You went up in the attic, you go across the way, and you were right down there backstage with the stars. So all these kids, they want to come meet the stars. They didn't, and the show was crap. You know, the light show was garbage. You know, it wasn't and it stopped being a real art form and just sort of being awful. And at the same time, my own personal health was doing, the nightlife was not for me, you know? And I went on a ride with an old friend of mine down in LA. I was down there visiting my grandparents and we rode for 10 miles and I had to sleep the rest of the day. And I said, this is wrong. I got to start riding the bike again. And I started riding and I got in good shape quick. You know, it really worked and it was intoxicating. Oh my God. My first race, I came back, you know, I did it was this criterium up in Davis, California, and all these big racers, you know, that I'd known when I was a teenager that were like, wow, these are the big guys were there. And so the last lap, I took a flyer, you know, with about a half a lap to go. It was I think a 1 mile course. And man, I got pipped on the line by like four people, you know, or three people, you know, I got fourth place. And that like, man, they never let me do that again. So, you know, I started making a comeback and I got second in Tour Nevada City and I blew the sprint. I just totally blew the sprint on that one. Could have won that one so easy. And I'm like, ugh.
And so at the same time as you're doing this road racing, there's the kind of beginnings of a sort of semi-organized off-road scene. And we're not talking about cyclocross here. We're talking about something different.
Well, that was, there wasn't much, you know, as far as being organized. You know, we had our race, you know, the repack race, you know. So it was the first sort of dirt time trial, you know. Charlie Kelly pretty much, you know, did that. And I helped them do it in the beginning. And I managed to win the thing a few times and then set the record on it, you know. And it was a scary thing for me. But that was about it.
Well, how about these people you mentioned, the Larkspur Canyon Gang? I mean, that sounds, what a great name.
They were a lot of fun. They were my friends in high school. They were doing like drum circles, the most organized things. And they'd have races, but it was like races within their own, you know, small community. It was tiny. It was a bunch of high school friends. And there was one guy, older guy, Casey Sonneband. And Casey Sonneband was a drummer, you know, conga drums. And they sort of invented the drum circle around here. And they, Casey would put on these events called the Dog Ball, you know, and it was like mostly just drumming and everything. And sometimes you'd be in the city and they do a poster for it. That was as organized as they ever got, you know, because, and the other thing that they do is derby night, derby time. And derby time is like somebody gets some beer, you know, either a keg or like a bunch of six packs, drag them out into the woods into like a place where like a few trails came together, big wide spot. And, you know, for the first hour would be cocktail hour. You'd be drinking beer and you'd be riding your bike around your clunker with, you know, a beer in one hand and, you know, trying not to spill so much. And then you get to serious derbying. And derbying was like where you go in front of somebody, stop, and try to get them to fall down. Okay. And then if you fell down, other people could ride over your bike. That was like, okay. The end of the night would be a bike pile, and the bikes would get piled up on top of each other, and people would bullshit, and smoke weed, and all that, you know, and then drag their bikes and their parts out of the woods. You know, it wasn't organized at all. You know, it was just a party scene going on.
And, but with bikes, but bikes were part of it. That's what it's interesting to me.
Definitely. Well, as a road rider, you get to like around in your training all the time, you get to know all your roads. And I mean all your roads, and in all your roads within like 50 mile radius, you know, all the roads, you know, everything. And any new road you want, and you get done with all of them. And then you like, we switch to like, you put your bike over the fence and go along a gravel road. And that was a big deal. Right. And so there was part that I deal with it, you know, but no, the Canyon Gang was all about thrills more. Rip, tear, shred, got to get some air. And that, you know, we did the other part, you know, the go through some gravel riding. And that happened in the 70s in a totally different place. That would be like Yopes Brandt. He was a hardcore road rider that I knew. And I'd go on these, it'd be a 100-mile ride and include, you know, 20 miles, 30 miles of dirt, you know. And you'd ride the classic tire was a Campeonato do Mundo Clement 27-millimeter tire, 700C sew up, you know. And that was you try to get your hands in some of those, or else you took a couple of sets of tires, you know, draped over your shoulders because they were going to be flats, you know. And, you know, that was I got an intro to gravel with that. But, and we did some cyclocross or road cross, you know, but the Canyon was a totally different thing. Canyon Boys. And that was, you know, we're going to go as fast as we can down this thing. Like one of the rides, trails you like to do is a thing called roller coaster. And I did it the other day, and it's, you know, it's a classic, you know, as far as like up and down, man, you get zero gravity on the up parts and everything. It was great. You know, that was sort of the new thing of like, wow, man, because I'd take a cross bike off road, you know, in the early 70s. And like, you'd have to take, you know, a few tires with you. And you'd wind up, you know, patching tires for a couple of hours, you know, every time you go ride. Real pain. And then you couldn't go really fast on the descents. You know, it's just too rocky. And, you know, you look at like the birthplace of cross and where cross is really big. Well, man, they got a lot of sand, some roots, and not a lot of rocks. You know, it's a really different animal, you know. So it's funny how things came along. But the whole thing, Clunkers was with Fred Wolf. He was a guy who like organized a lot of the rides, you know, and I'd come along with him. I'd go out on my training ride in the morning, you know, I might ride 100 miles, you know, on a road bike, and then call up in the afternoon and say, hey, we're going to do a moonlight ride, an afternoon ride or something. And you just, you know, I just go in what I was wearing, which is Levi's denim shirts, stuff like that, just around the house, you know, put on a pair of either, you know, running shoes, so I use those a lot of the time, and sometimes you'd use steel toe boots just if it was like big rocks and stuff.
And so these were social rides or races?
They were social rides. They weren't races.
And how did the racing come out of these social rides? This sort of clunkers thing. When did you, you know, because it's one thing to go out for a moonlight ride and enjoy each other's company, enjoy being in nature, and then suddenly you're racing them.
Yeah, well, that was the repack.
Yeah.
And the repack, it was a few years of that, and then there started to be other races. And the other big race, okay, the other big race, this is the one, was Rosita to the Sea. And this is put on by a guy, Victor Vincente. And it was, I think it was 1980, 81. But this was announced at the Long Beach Trade Show. So Victor Vincente, oh my God, this is Michael Hiltner. He changed his name. Michael Hiltner, I knew him in the 60s. He won that inaugural National Road Championships down in L.A., you know, and I think it was 66, you know, and he was, you know, on the Olympic team in, I think, 1960, 64. He was a really top-notch, you know, road racer. And he dropped acid, man. And he changed his name, and he did a cross-country ride. And he went all the way west coast to the east coast, liked it so much, turned around and came back. And so he, like, broke the record for riding across the United States and changed his name to Victor Vincente of America. So because he was victorious twice. Anyway, here in the, you know, here we are down at the show, 1980, and we're on like just a 10 by 10 piece of concrete, you know. I mean, it was like our very first show. And there's Victor. He's got a show. He's like got a lawn chair, one of his bikes, and he made an off-road bike with two 20-inch wheels, you know, with alloy rims. And he was putting on a race, Rosita to the Sea. And everybody, there were a lot of people, not everybody, but a huge amount of people at the show were like speculating on who was going to win the race. You know, is it going to be a BMX rider? Was it going to be a road rider? Was it going to be a cyclocrosser or one of these newfangled things I call the mountain bike, you know? And a lot of people came and the press came, you know, the bicycle press came to the event. And I had ridden my bike 2 weeks before that. We'd ridden on a training ride from San Francisco to LA, you know, and sort of a circuitous route. And Greg LeMond was on that ride and his dad, Bob, and everything. Man, I was fit and ready to go. So the race started and my major competition was Ron Skarin. Ron Skarin and Steve Grossman, his teammate from North Hollywood Wheelman. Ron was a multiple Olympian, you know, and had won the nationals a number of times, you know, both on the pursuit on the track, and he was a criterium specialist, you know, and a good road racer. So they were on like these titanium Teledyne Titan road bikes, and they both had cyclocross tires on. And so the first 4 miles of the race were like a climb on pavement, and I'm there with my bike, you know, steel frame. It's a, like around 27 pound bike. With Uniroyal tires, you know, because that was the only tire worth really doing off-road at the time. And I stayed with him on the climb. We got to the dirt, and I said, bye. And I won by 4 minutes, you know. And it helped. It was one of those races that helped put the whole controversy to rest of, like, what this bike is good for, you know. And the original bike, it was, you know, about going from point A to point B in the woods and everything. And, you know, it's really... The bike has morphed into like, man, do you want to have fun? You know, rip, tear, shred, got to get some air. That's what's really changed, is the bike is really suitable for that. You know, back then, I mean, you didn't have any kind of suspension. Oh, man, you come down a lot of these hills and you'd have to stop halfway through and just go like this. It was like holding on to a paint can shaker. Like, and I do not kid you. It was so intense, you know. And that's the thing that blows my mind, is that it was a huge attraction and a huge hit, even though, like, we didn't have this technology yet.
I mean, maybe that's a nice, interesting way to look at the invention of the mountain bike, rather than saying, aha, here comes the mountain bike, this kind of platonic form that nobody until then had come up with, actually was the result of you trying to address a bunch of problems associated right. with existing types of bicycle.
Right, because it was incredible in that on one hand, it was an extremely practical bike, you know, that it had a relatively upright position. It had a relatively wide tire. It had plenty of gearing, plenty of brakes, and, you know, you felt absolutely secure. And at the same time, it was very practical, but at the same time, it had this totally crazy image going for it.
I mean, it's, you know, it's the major type of bicycle sold worldwide, I would think, has been for many years. But very few mountain bikes are ever ridden over a mountain. Yet this term mountain bike that you came up with really stuck.
Okay. At one point, Bicycling Magazine, all right, Chuck McCullough, he was the editor at the time. He said in his editorial, I want to come up with an alternate name because Gary Fisher owns the bike name, mountain bike name. So we got to come up with an alternative. And they did a big survey, a big contest, and it was ATB, all-terrain bike, right? And the only ones that sort of followed that were the French.
Yeah.
Or the French had to do it, and they did it independently, of course. They're like, Velo tout terrain, you know?
And so were there other names on the drawing board with you? Was it always just going to be mountain bike? Or was it so obvious? Were there other things that you might have called it?
That one was a big one that just stood out because it was just powerful. That one was
tell us some of the ones that didn't that it could have been.
Oh,
can you remember?
No, that's what I'm saying, because I could tell you the stories of a lot of other names and how they sort of like evolved. You know, I could tell you those because I've been through a lot of those. I mean, it's still involved in the naming thing. You know, it's like now it's like with all the product that we do and everything, I tell all the product managers, everybody, you think of a name for this thing first. That's the first thing I want you to do, because we've had classic situations. I can never forget, like, here we are, we're over in Germany, we're doing our European show. Like the head of product at the time is showing me this new feature of all of our, you know, these lower end bikes. It's like a utility port. You know, it's like you can plug in a rack, you can plug in, you know, a trailer, you can plug all these different things into this thing. And like, here it is, it's in the catalog and everything. And I'm saying, hey man, what do you call this thing? There was no name for it. I couldn't believe it. I said, how can this thing exist and not have a name? You know, this is like having a child without a name, you know, think about it. You know, it's like, oh, and like, my guys are like, why is Gary coming in glued? It's like, it's because you don't understand that this whole project has got to have emotion behind it, that you can't have it unless thing has got a name and a reason, a wrap, the whole thing, you know. It's like, you know, product is so funny. I mean, it's like the three-legged stool is like, you got to have a great design, which is the name is part of that. A lot of hype, you know, you got to market the thing like crazy. Then you got to deliver the product. That's the big deal, you know, and that was where, you know, my company, we got out ahead right away. And then I worked really hard on trying to get, you know, product, you know, and like be able to get it. And like in the early days, it was like, we built all the frames in the United States. We did all the assembly. We did all the painting. We did everything, you know, and like I'd import these parts from so many different places, you know, the crank sets and the brakes from France, you know, the brake levers from Germany.
To the business side of stuff, Gary, the idea of taking your passion and making a livelihood out of it, it's a big jump, and it's not always worked for people. And in fact, I go to say that more than often it doesn't work. Even if you're a great innovator, you're not necessarily a great salesman. And even if you are both of those things, that doesn't always lead to business success. I mean, I know you've had your ups and downs in kind of the bike industry. Do you have any reflections on those that might be helpful to other people out there who are thinking about how to turn their passion for cycling into a kind of livelihood?
Choose what you want to be and the size, and work hard on choosing your customers. And all that stuff sounds really simple, but no, it's... especially the choose your customers part. You know, you don't have to be the biggest to be completely successful. And yeah, you got to grow at the right speed and do the right thing.
So it's about having a tribe.
You know, be only as big as your group of people. You know, you've got to treat your own people right.
So if I can look at history in a comparative way, maybe you'll say this is unfair, but at around about the time, and in fact, not just the time, but the same place, the same milieu, in a way, the same way of thinking, came up with a personal computer, all right, the Apple Mac and all this. Yeah. And now we've all got these personal computers that we have in our pockets, that we do everything through. Yet the bicycle is still in the margins in society. It hasn't taken over. It's, you know, Trek or whichever is not the biggest company in the world. You know, if right. bicycles had followed the trajectory of microcomputers, we'd be in a very different world than we are now.
Yeah.
But the bicycle is as powerful as a microcomputer for what it does in terms of personal mobility with the efficiency right. that it has. Why did one do the thing that it did and the other is still kind of on the margins?
It's like, it's, you know, the microcomputer has been coming on for a while. I mean, I think in our business, the first one we had was like an 82, you know, and it's, now it got to the point really quickly. It's like, you can't do business without it. You know, you take all your stuff off, you know, it gets that way. And we're not there. You know, we're not a necessity at the moment, but I think that's going to come. I mean, there's the only way you can hit these numbers for reduction of carbon is to start using bikes a lot more and using this technology. It is, you know, it is an e-bike, especially. That's the world's most efficient motorized vehicle. I mean, an e-bike battery, all right, a Tesla battery equals about 200 e-bike batteries as far as its footprint goes, as far as all that goes, as far as this is energy use, it's recycling, all that. It's so much smaller. And this is the logic that people have got to get, is that to hit those kind of numbers, man, you got to not be trying to push that sort of energy. You can't bring along your rumpus room, your kitchen, your toolbox everywhere you go. You know, this is like ridiculous, you know, and we come to this ridiculous point in time. And that's, you know, the necessity has got to be there through the desire, and desire can be brought, you know. I mean, I got to say, I mean, the microcomputer, you know, being able to haul this thing around everywhere I go. I mean, it's like I make a joke. I say, yeah, my wife's a third of my brain and this is the other third of my brain, you know, but I'm three times as smart as I was. And that's the truth, you know, and I can figure out a lot more stuff on my own. And we all love that part of it and everything. And the same with this type of mobility, you know, that was the hit that always blew me away. It's like when I was a kid and everything, I was able to ride 80 miles on spaghetti, you know, a plate of spaghetti, you know, that was about it. It was amazing, you know, and it wasn't this, you know, overkill machine and everything, this whole big polluting thing. Cause that was the other thing that was going on like crazy, is like every time you go to LA, we call it chocolate air. I mean, it was really brown down there. And it would get bad here in the Bay Area as well, you know, and it was obvious, you know, and they had this whole, we had the interstate freeway whole thing going on. And then there were freeway wars, you know, where like on TV, you'd see people that were like refusing to leave their houses. And the sheriff would come with the papers and take them away. And a bulldozer would come and tear down their place. And I was like, what are we doing? You know, they replace this with this freeway. And it was like, there was quite a bit of pushback. I mean, the freeway guys totally won out, but there was and there always has been a fair amount of pushback. But now we look at numbers, you know, numbers coming out of New York City. I think, you know, they recently did a big survey and people like it the way it is better than the way it was, you know, and they realize that they give up a lot when they give over everything to parking. So there is more of a movement, and the people that from my generation that know no other way are just literally dying. And I don't want to wait that long.
I'm not sure that they're being replaced by better people necessarily. And I think within the bicycle world, one of our failings is we focus a little bit too much on the bicycle rather than the environment in which the bicycle is used. And I know you've talked a lot about that. There's a lot of that in your call to action towards the end of the book about urban design, about what the Dutch have got right. It's going to take more than the bicycle industry to kind of change the way you know, space is allocated, the way the rules of the road, the way everything works at the moment to prioritize car travel. And we've got to change this around. How are we going to do that? As a salesman and as a kind of innovator and a guy who's changed the bike, how do we change our streets?
You know, the micro mobility people, the people like they're doing all that. A number of them have money. They got more money than the bike people, and they really believe in marketing things right.
So this is scooters, are you saying, like electric scooters and that sort of thing?
You bet, man. Scooters, like on the 25th of September, there's a big, I don't know what they're going to do with it right now, because everything could change how big it's going to be. But there's a big micro mobility meetup here in San Francisco. So it's all kinds of stuff. I mean, you know, electric skateboards are pretty incredible because you just pick that little thing up, you know, and you're gone with it. You know, and that, like, you can go into a restaurant, you can go on another form of transport, just boom, like that. And the same with scooters. They're, you know, they're relatively small. They don't take up a lot of space. And that's their big thing we're campaigning about is like, hey, if you take out all this car parking, you could have all the space you need. You know, all these car jams and all this stuff could be a thing of the past. You guys are living in a stone age. You don't have to do it this way. We're looking at Paris and what they did and some of the other cities and everything. And it's amazing. You can get rid of all that, the issues with getting around, and you can make your populace healthier, because that's the other thing, the other big elephant in the room. It's still, for the UK and the United States and a lot of other countries, cardiovascular is the number one cause of death. And it's not pretty, because, you know, you get people that are immobile, you know, that have, you know, we both our countries suffer this. And it's like, my line is, you know, I have a solution. I'm very open to yours. I'm listening. I haven't heard anything, because they don't have a solution that works. You know, it's been proven. Putting in more lanes just like takes up more space and makes an uglier place. You know, it doesn't get people there. You know, and it's hilarious. We got all the data to like back us up and everything. And it's really, it comes down to a lot of politics and a lot of marketing with the thing. And that's what we're trying to figure out. My services with the micro mobility will be how to make your stuff really cool.
Okay. So you got to make the thing that you're trying to sell cool. And how about the
and
thing,
everything else.
And how about the thing that people are wedded to through a century of promotion by the industry itself, by governments, that the automobile is tied up with status. As you said earlier on in the 1950s, like a bicycle was for someone who was like, who'd been banned from driving, or a kid, or someone with no money. And a car is still being seen and sold as a promise of high status, freedom, safety, all the rest of it. Can you just be cooler than that? Or are we going to have to grasp the nettle and start restricting the freedom to drive a car wherever you want it to go at a pretty low cost?
It's both. I mean, absolutely. And it's this, like, that's a huge thing. I mean, like I said, when I come over the top of the hill, I look down there at Standard Oil and I go like, these guys are going to shut this. They don't have a plan to shut this down. No way. You know, and it's a real attitude. And I can totally, you know, appreciate it that, you know, no, we have no other plan, but nothing lasts forever, you know, and it's the biggest change, the hardest change is always what's between the ears, all that gray matter. I mean, once you change that, everything else is easy. You know that, you know. So that's where a lot more work has to be done, is like providing solutions and saying, hey, dude, you don't have any clothes on. Do you know that? And it doesn't look very good.
And do you think all the technical stuff is essentially there? Or is there stuff in the realm of bikes and micro mobility that you are looking forward to the day when they invent that thing that can do this? Or do you think like we've pretty much got it and we just need to orient our environment towards it?
We got it. We got so many good people, that really good engineers and a lot of good cooperation in industry. People love making bike stuff. You know, it's, of course, they love making medical stuff better. It pays better. I'm sorry. But no, we've got a tremendous group of people that we never had before. That was the thing, the most striking thing in the 50s. Oh, you were totally an outlier. In the 60s, you were lonely. In the 70s, it was tiny, you know, and it's been growing and growing and growing, you know, and that's because we have a highly addictive activity.
So when people read your book, they're going to read a great life story, beautifully illustrated with some fantastic photography, some brilliant layout, and they're going to capture this amazing meeting of worlds, which I still can't quite get over, of like road racing plus like the Grateful Dead and light shows. But what do you hope that they'll come away with? What do you want people to read this and get up and do?
People generally, they take it a little at a time, okay? And they said so many stories, you know, I come back and come back and back for another gem, and it makes them feel good. And then, you know, I'm trying to have more of a call to action, you know, more people having the catching that thing that, yeah, despite all these odds, despite all the, you know, righteous things you're talking about, because those, the other forces, boy, they market every single day and they play every avenue they can. They're great examples of how to do things. Okay. Despite that, we can bend things our way quite a bit and have a very, very good time doing it and feel very good.
And is there still room in the bike industry of 2021 for the kind of DIY culture that I guess your life epitomizes?
Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, and it's like that's, you know, for us too. I mean, our biggest, most powerful, you know, sector has been the customization thing, you know, and just that. And, you know, and we customize to a fair degree, but then there are people that do anything, do crazy stuff, and you can find them. And they're way deep into their thing and they do a great job. So the people out there that are tiny that are doing just fine, you know, in the bike world. And that, you know, I love that, you know, that needs to stay happening. And the thing that's going to help them do more is this thing about printing things, you know, with your printer, you know, printing parts and stuff. That
whole 3D printing. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Cause that's going to bring it right back into your own little shop, your own little place. You'll be able to make some pretty sophisticated stuff with that, you know? So it's sort of, that's sort of like taking the middleman out of the whole thing. And you don't have to like deal with somebody overseas or do any of that. It's sort of, that's amazing. I'm thinking of buying one pretty soon just to see what type of little goodies I can make and stuff, you know, just, and you know, cause the thing is you get one of those, you get a scanner and you know, and then there are people that will scan things and work on it, you know, and be able to ship you a program. Here's this part, man.
And is there, I'm going to ask this as a last question, is there a bicycle that is available on the market now that if someone rides it, they will experience what Gary Fisher wants it to feel like to ride a bike? You know, like a really well-cut suit, you know, that has your style, and they'll be able to relate to you through an object, or is that just a pipe dream?
You bring up exactly, and the bespoke bicycle, the bespoke suit, there's a lot to be said for that, you know, to make, oh, you don't like a suit because none of your stuff fits you, you know, you don't like this bike because it didn't fit you, you know, and there's so many ways, so many little details on the thing. And that's why like the bike dealer is going to exist for a long time. And that's what it is. It's like you come in and you expect like this person knows about everything, all the latest stuff, and they can look me over and help me find and guide me to the right stuff. That's super important. So like, that's not going away. The human touch, the human being to get in there. I mean, that's like, my wife's a family doctor and you know, that's a general medicine, and that there's a higher demand for that than ever before, because people really want to have a gatekeeper. They want to have somebody that really spends the time and finds out what's going on, because man, the thing you find out about all this stuff, it's never simple. Therefore, there's space for us human beings still.
So there isn't a particular model, a particular line that you would like people to throw their leg over and give it a try.
Here's the funny thing. There's a bike that I campaign for a lot within Trek. It's called the Marlin. And this bike is under $1,000. It's just a simple mountain bike. And the idea is that all the parts, I said to my guys, it's like, why don't we pick a bike, make a line of bikes that is made out of parts that don't break, you know, that we don't get returns on, that are also parts that are easy to find worldwide, dimensions that are easy to find worldwide, and have very reliable suppliers so that we can all get this. I tell you. And then the frames are, you know, it's new technology. So it's hydroformed aluminum, you know, and it's really a good job. You know, we've got the alloys down. We got the hydroforming, you know, it takes a big computer, a good computer program to make it right. It's incredible what we can make, and incredible paint, really cool graphics. And the bike is arguably the largest selling mountain bike in the world. So I'm getting inching closer to covering the earth with bikes. Go to your local bike shop, find somebody you connect with eye to eye, and that's it. And then also find a group to ride with that you like, because that will get you out more than anything. But if you want to grow, you know, it's this way. If you grow to grow the market, you grow the pie by making events to show up to and to go to. You make the market spend more money on their product by doing competitions, because people show up and if everybody's on a better bike than them, then they go out and buy a better bike. And then it becomes an arms race. But I you know, it's still, you can spend 15K on a bike, you know, these days on a nice road bike. And I never feel bad about that, because these bikes are made in a way of something from Formula One or from NASA. And you cannot own those objects. You know, this is the way these things are made. They're incredible. I've shown our frames to a friend of mine that works at NASA. And he says, I don't know if we make anything that's nice. You know, he's looking at the way we do it. And it's, you can actually own that thing. And then you can feel the difference. They're a miracle. They're amazing how those things ride. So I never feel bad about it. As long as we're still making bikes that are relatively cheap, relatively simple, and a good deal, you know, and we'll always continue to do that. And then there's this whole new categories, and the new categories are taking stuff around with you. And that's especially enhanced by the electric bike, because you don't mind taking around a little extra. It's just fine.
Gary, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. May you keep doing what you've been doing for decades now. Wish you all good health and, well, all the happiness in the world.
Well, thank you so much. Thanks for this time.
I was talking with Gary Fisher, and I'm still here with Guy Andrews and Guy Kesteven, who published and co-wrote this brilliant new book, Being Gary Fisher. It's difficult when you talk to iconic figures in any field, I think, really, because they're quite used to telling stories about themselves, because they've done a lot of interviews, and you almost want to take things off into different dimensions. You don't want to be asking them to repeat themselves the whole time. And also, sometimes there are sensitivities in a story which, you know, as a friendly interviewer, you have to sort of skirt around a little bit. So what I'd like to do in our chat now is to go into some of those things that I didn't cover, or I didn't feel comfortable covering, or just we didn't simply have time to cover in our chat, if that's all right with you both. So this origin story of the mountain bike, which is something that has been quite contested, and I think people, I don't know if they've actually fully fallen out about it, but there has been debate, and there is debate, and I think there is an academic paper out there somewhere about who invented the mountain bike. I mean, is that a sensible question to ask, who invented the mountain bike?
In a word, no. I mean, it's something that Gary's really honest about, and what attracted, you know, and what kind of got me on board with the story straight away is he admits that in the mid-90s, there was a lot of hype generated around his name as the father of mountain biking, and that caused an absolute stink. But he's kind of now he's much more lucid about the fact that people have been riding off bikes off road by definition for longer than there've been roads, because there were no roads when people started. And you can pretty much stick a pin in the map anywhere and find a bicycle equipped or modified to ride off road, whether it's the 30s, 50s, bomb sites in Paris, woodsy bikes in the woods of Wisconsin, whatever. What Gary did was name mountain bikes and create a massive fuss about him. And I mean, even what's interesting is when you start digging into it, even the people that there's more general aware of, like Joe Breeze, like Tom Ritchie, like Scott Nickel from Ibis, probably haven't got the prior claim anyway. I mean, there's a whole different segment of off-road riding in Southern California. There's people like the Kosky brothers at the Cove Bike Store who met up with Mert Lawwell, who's another icon from mountain biking, and produced a really, really advanced bike. But as Gary was quite honest about, he said, we just got our catalogue out faster. It took them 6 months to get their catalogue out. And in that time, Gary Fisher had built a bike that was probably not as good, although he reckons it had better brakes, and got it out there and got it selling. He beat, you know, he was the one who took something that was just, that had been carrying on for a very long time, endemically, all over the place, all over the world, and he named it and he sold it.
Guy Andrews, how would you see Gary's part in the kind of founding fathers within the sort of Marin County scene, which I think is sort of where we do see the emergence of that object that is recognisably a mountain bike that he then, as Guy Kesteven said, got the catalogue out first. Was he brazing frames? Was he mechanically minded as well?
I think Gary was definitely very mechanically minded. I mean, he was a mechanic, you know, in a bike shop, and that's how he started out, sort of tinkering about with bikes, like kind of a lot of us did. But I think the real contrast, if you like, with Gary and Joe Breeze and Tom Ritchie and Charlie Kelly is Gary is the personality. Gary's the one that wants to get in front of the TV to as Guy Kesteven said earlier, to sell the shit out of it, because that's in his nature. I mean, he's just one of these characters that's happy to sell. Joe Breeze is a wonderful engineer and a really engaging guy, but he's definitely a quiet private person, and was happy to build the first 10, arguably the first 10 mountain bikes that we now know as being kind of the first, if you like, the first geared clunkers, should we say. But I think that the argument is whipped up, or has been whipped up, by the media down the years. I think Gary's almost slightly embarrassed about it, because it's kind of like I don't think he ever claimed to be the father of mountain biking. Although I don't think he'd ever deny that claim either, because you know it suits his story. But I think it's a tricky one. I mean, I think of all the founding fathers, it's interesting that Tom Ritchie, who made the first mountain bike frames for Gary and Charlie's company, Mountain Bikes, he's the only one who's remains in cycling as a brand. Tom Ritchie is a well-known brand across all aspects of sort of high-performance cycling. So, you know, he's still around from that point of view. So he actually built a sustainable business, if you like, and the rest of them have all kind of fallen away a little.
Yeah, I think one thing that came out during the process of writing the book is how incredibly curious Gary is about innovation, whether that's, you know, doing light shows and stuff for the Grateful Dead, or when he was a kid racer, he had a bike specifically built to be as lightweight as possible with simplex gears on it and all sorts of things that were totally left field at the time when everybody else was using Campag. Because he was a really light, skinny kid, he had a custom-built frame with cyclocross cantilevers because they were lighter than the side pulls. So even on the road scene, he was an innovator. And then when you move into mountain biking, he was actually testing for Bicycling magazine while he was creating a lot of the early clunkers. So a lot of those innovations came from early access to things like Shimano Positron gears to Dura Ace free hubs, which enabled him to make a stronger, wider rear axle on his bike. And, you know, even to the point of brazing Campag rear dropouts onto his front forks so he could experiment with different offset, which the offset he came on with 26-inch wheels didn't actually change until very, very recently, when again, he kind of stepped it forwards and introduced different offsets on 29er forks. And all the way through the book, whatever he's doing, there's this incredible memory accuracy for the technical side of things, right down to like tubing diameters, wall thicknesses, all that kind of thing. You know, he is a super geek. You know, he's right up there.
Something that I'm really interested in is the collaboration between California and Japan, and I suppose later Taiwan, in cycling, in mountain biking. I think we often see the mountain bike as this Californian thing, but actually it was as much a Pacific Rim phenomenon, because it was with the mountain bike, am I right, that Shimano sort of ascended to become the mighty Shimano that we all know now as the sort of, you know, biggest bicycle component manufacturer in the world. And Gary played a part in that, didn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. If you go back to when the mountain bike comes around, Campagnolo were totally dominant. One of the local races to Gary actually had a prize for the first bike to finish that didn't have Campagnolo on it. It was that dominant. And the Japanese just saw the fact that, I mean, because they'd watched BMX and companies like Araya, Tangay, and construction companies like that had got on board with components. But obviously, with a mountain bike, you've got a whole level of extra gears for a start. I mean, Shimano are a freewheel company. That's how they started out. And suddenly you've got this whole other arena to create gears for. And I think it's what's interesting is how slow, as much as the Japanese were very fast to react, the European bike brands are incredibly slow. I mean, the only contribution from European bike brands was really Magura giving Gary a trade account for motorbike brake levers for his early clunkers. I mean, Campagnolo has only ever produced two mountain bike group sets in the mid-90s, and they were dreadful. And they went from having this utterly dominant sort of, well, I guess, arrogant position where they completely ruled it. And Shimano just took the legs right under them and grabbed this new category, which turned out to be this huge sort of revolutionary revenue recognition grower, and just owned it. You know, Panaracer, Suntour, Bridgestone, all these Japanese brands just jumped straight in there, and they became the innovators. And the actual Japanese frame companies were really, really well set up to make mountain bikes. I mean, Gary describes going over there and just seeing these incredible rooms at Shimano where there's nobody in there apart from these machines just stamping out cassettes and cogs, and factories where literally raw tubing went in one end and a painted bike came out the other.
So yeah, I think the one interesting thing about the California-Japan connection was that was another thing that Gary purposefully went out to do. You know, it sounded like a lot of the other mountain bike folks at the time wouldn't have even thought of doing that. You know, they were quite happy to keep churning things out in their own sheds, and that's, you know, sort of that supplied the demand at the time. Obviously, Gary had bigger ideas and realised that, you know, the only way to get this to a wider audience was to be able to manufacture on a large scale, which is obviously, you know, bikes in boxes was kind of what Gary was all about. And I think that was a revolutionary part of the bike industry for that part of the 1980s. You know, it was something that, you know, that you never did. You know, you built a bike from the ground up. You didn't buy a bike in a box at that time. And if you did, it was a very cheap bike. So Gary revolutionized that.
So he was an innovator. He had these great sparks of inspiration in terms of teaming up with Japan. He was a brilliant salesman, yet he didn't make a fortune running his own company. In fact, his own company ran into trouble fairly soon, didn't it? I tried to get him to elaborate a little bit on his reflections on life in the bike biz, you know, making money out of bikes. But he sidestepped the question a little bit. So kind of what happened, and why did Gary Fisher's, you know, business career not turn out as successfully as it might have done?
I think one of my favorite quotes from the whole book is that I want this book to be handed out in business classes as an example of how to do things, but also as an absolute example as how not to do things on a regular basis. And I think you can boil it all down to the fact that Gary gets massively distracted. And I know a lot of the Taiwanese problems, where he was basically getting sold frames that were cracked already or overpainted or had old componentry on them, he got taken by a ride by the Taiwanese company he was working with because he was racing his bike too much. I mean, he was going for Olympic selection at the time. He was racing with Greg LeMond. He was having a fine old time. He'd had 20 years of doing all these bikes all by himself, and suddenly the Taiwanese are like, yeah, we'll do that for you, Gary. We'll have your name. We'll sort it all out. By the time he realized it was an absolute nightmare, he was too busy racing, you know? So that's when that happened. And again, I think just things like him not painting the mountain bike name, it was just a detail he didn't drill into because there's so much more going on. And then he eventually brokered this deal with Trek, which was brilliant, but he was still a maverick within Trek. And what's interesting, although he was really, really cheesed off when they killed the Gary Fisher brand because they kind of parked it.
Back up a bit there, Guy, and tell us what happened with Trek. I mean, so Gary Fish, from what I understand, is Gary Fisher's business got into trouble and he kind of had to essentially sell the name, his name, and go and work with Trek, who then took on the brand within the Trek family. And he was taken on as spokesman, you know, maverick, whatever. But ultimately, they were Trek bikes. Is that right?
Partially right. Trek, when Gary moved there, they were very unexciting. They barely did any marketing. They sold really good, solid touring bikes. And they had some respectable bikes right across the category. They didn't have sponsored athletes, anything like that. And at the time, Trek kind of just, well, they kind of vejazzled themselves with luminaries right across the bike scene. So they picked up LeMond. They picked up Keith Bontrager. They picked up Gary Klein, all of which are iconic people. And they picked up Gary Fisher as well. But interesting, Gary Fisher, rather than just kind of going, okay, have my name and kind of do a pastiche of what I was doing already, which is kind of what happened with Klein and really what happened with Bontrager, they produced some privateer bikes and then, you know, he became the name of a component line. And let's not go into Le Monde. Gary Andrews can go into Le Monde on an entirely different podcast. But Gary actually went fully hands-on. He rightfully says that Trek's now are much more like Gary Fisher bikes than they are Trek bikes. You know, you can pick out a load of different technology. I mean, 29er is the obvious ones, but even oversized tires like the Trek Rumblefish started on the Gary Fisher range, different fork offsets, different geometries. It was kind of their experimental arm right the way through. And because Trek were kind of moving more and more of these innovations and platforms across to Trek, they didn't really need Gary Fisher. He almost became an unwelcome competitor. But yeah, like I say, he was really, really cheesed off when he finally went from Gary Fisher to Gary Fisher Collection to him just being kind of an ambassador and stuff. But then he realized he was still getting a paycheck and basically he could go around the world wearing his suits and, you know, bigging up biking, which I think is a role he's pretty happy with now.
Finally, I just want to round off reflections on Gary and your time with him producing the book by thinking about what we might learn going forward and what we might do differently in cycling, looking at him as an inspiration. There's a film on YouTube that I only discovered the other day, and I think it's been up there for a while, and it's a really well-made little film about a bike ride in, I think, 1980. In Colorado, one of the kind of clunkers events called the Crested Butte Classic, I think. And I will put a link to it from the Bike Show webpage. You can search for it, Crested Butte Clunker Classic, and it comes in two parts. But just to give you a little flavor, here's a short edit from the audio track of that film.
Clunker is a balloon-tired bicycle. We have several of them here. It's essentially an old newspaper boy bicycle that's been converted to use in the mountains. And there's still a lot of clunkers that are one-speed bicycles, coaster brake bicycles, your old newspaper boy bicycle. And that's a $75 bicycle. And they have evolved to $1,500, 12, 15, 18-speed, highly sophisticated pieces of machinery.
Yeah, we put a lot of gears on it. This one's 18 speeds, weighs in at about 26 pounds. It's real light. We have all kinds of little trick devices on it that we've come up with over the last 8 or 9 years of this kind of riding. It's more of a party than a ride, actually. It just happens to attract the element we all like, you know?
O'clock we'll ride from here to Cumberland Basin, which is probably close to 20 miles, somewhere around 20 miles. We'll ride up there. Some people will arrive at camp in 3 or 4 hours. The rest of us old folks will get there 4 o'clock in the afternoon. By that time there'll be a big fire going, kegs of beer set out. People will start quenching their thirst and we'll have dinner. Be a lot of bike talk around the campfire. Go to bed. Up early in the morning for the hardest part of the climb, pushing the bike that last 2,000 feet up to the top of Pearl Pass.
I'm not a serious fanatic bike rider, so I'm going to be taking it easy and having a good time.
You can hit like 40 miles an hour down some of these hills. So it's totally thrilling, it's total exercise, and it's getting away from the cops, the cars, the concrete, and getting out here.
No, no, nothing is under control. If everything were under control, it wouldn't be any fun.
Pearl Pass is definitely the rockiest thing that we ever ride. I mean, it's insane. That downhill is just unrivaled. I mean, you, depending on how far you want to hang it, and it just turns your arms, your shoulders, your hands to mush. It's really hard on bikes, too. Bikes that we think are super strong and everything, stuff fails on it. That's one of the big reasons we like to come here, too, because we build bikes all year long, but hey, this is the baddest test. You know, this one really, if you can survive this, the rest of it is pretty easy. The Rocky Mountains are named because they're rocky.
So that was a little taster of the Crested Butte Clunker classic film, which you can find on YouTube. And I have to say, I fell in love with that film. It just presented a kind of cycling that seems just so joyful and free and lacking in ego and just wonderful. Everything that I like about cycling is kind of in that film, just people having fun on bikes, being together in a wonderful landscape and being slightly about it. Obviously, it's a very different time and place. It's Colorado in the 1980s, so like 40 years ago. It feels connected to our time in a way that a film about, you know, a CTC ride in the 1970s might feel a bit kind of antique. And it seems a lot more fun than, you know, the slightly regimented world of the cycling club that preceded it. That scene, that way of being, seems to be a really important contribution from that whole era, and you know, set aside the technology of the mountain bike, just the way they rode their bikes is wonderful to watch, and maybe we could learn something from that. That's a kind of really long way of asking a question, but what do you think that we could learn from those early days of the mountain bike and Gary Fisher's life in cycling?
I think there's one thing in the book. It's a quote, and I'm not quite sure who we can attribute it to, but it's basically no cars, no cops, no concrete. And I think that's kind of where that whole clunker scene sort of developed from. You know, this whole ethos that, you know, you need to get off the roads, you need to get away from the city, you need to be away from the hassle. You know, and that was what it was, kind of the original ethos behind it all. I think Crested Butte was a sort of celebration of that almost. It was like a weekend where everybody just gets away in the middle of nowhere, you know, has a great time. And as you say, it's certainly not an organized affair like you'd have in a European country. So I think it was a very unique time. I think in some respects, it's slowly going full circle, coming back to that kind of idea behind cycling. And I really do hope that continues, because I think what we have got now is we've got way too obsessed with, you know, what you need to buy in order to go cycling, and, you know, technology and all of this sort of stuff, when actually the reality is the reason why we go cycling is because we love the freedom. You know, we love being outside, and we love, you know, being away from all the hassles of modern day life. And I think that was the ethos behind the clunker movement, if you like. And I think it's the, you know, it's the ethos behind what I see in cycling, and I think what a lot of people get from cycling.
Gary approached us with the whole idea that this book was to be delivering his vision of bikes as a solution for many, many of the world's problems, whether that's traffic, whether that's personal freedom, whether that's physical exercise. And we kind of had to strap on the story, almost like the three stages of Rocket Booster on a Saturn V, you know, to give it kind of some weight and give it some context. But I think it kind of boils down to, we've been really, really guilty of selling cycling. I mean, I'm particularly guilty of this as a technical editor for the past 25 years. By head angle, not headspace. You know, we need to sell the experience, sell the fact that it's a vehicle, an incredibly efficient vehicle, not just from a mechanical sense, but in also for meeting people, for breaking down barriers, for expanding your personal horizons. And just, you know, you look, and like you say, you watch that video, or you look back at the early pioneers of clunking, and it's such a diverse collection of people. It's just wonderful to see, but also quite depressing when you kind of look at the demographic that seems to dominate, that's traditionally dominated cycling. But I think more than ever, we're now at a time when we're seeing cycling massively expanding back into those areas. You know, whether COVID's been a really, really helpful catalyst, I think. You know, even in terms of riders who have a riding experience, having that window of going, oh, wow, if there's no traffic, this is so much more pleasant. And now, speaking to people, what you're seeing is even dyed-in-the-wool road riders are now going, actually, now traffic's back. I don't like riding on the road so much. Maybe I'll do gravel biking. Maybe I'll get a mountain bike. Maybe I'll go and sleep in a hedge. We've commoditized cycling. We've made it far too technical. We've gone down a rabbit hole of appearing to the tech side, appearing to, dare we say it, the male side, when actually it's such an open field. It's such a great thing to encourage anyone to do, whether they're school age, whether they're just about to roll off this world and can't walk anymore. You can still have a roll along on an e-bike. And I think that's the payload that this book was meant to deliver. And hopefully Gary's happy we've done that.
Guy Andrews, the publisher, I'm not going to ask you to add to what Guy Kesteven has just said, because I think he just brought together all the threads of this story in a really beautiful way there. But one thing we haven't mentioned is the visual quality of this book, and the way you've brought this story to life in pictures, not just by accessing photos, but the way you've laid them out, the way you've designed the book, the way you've interspersed photographs with drawings and catalogues and things like that. Congratulations. This book is as much a book to look at as it is a book to read.
Well, yeah, thanks, Jack. I mean, it's in no small part thanks to Alton Coyle and Alex Ferguson, the two guys who helped design the book and brought an awful lot to the party. I mean, we could probably do a whole podcast on how the book was designed. It's a very complex approach, and I think it's kind of a colourful celebration of Gary's life, which is exactly what we wanted to do. We wanted to throw the kitchen sink at this book. We wanted to have everything in there to help support the story, because I think it's a very integral part of Gary's story. This is the way he embraces great design and great photography, great illustration. I mean, we used a lot of illustrators as well to help tell the stories that we didn't have pictures of. And a lot of the photography came directly from Gary and his extensive archive. So, you know, there was a lot to pull together, a hell of a lot to pull together. And it's in no small part due to Alton, Alex and Taz Darling, who worked on the images. It took a lot longer than any other book we've ever worked on. And I think anyone who buys the book will see that for themselves. Each page is a different story. We wanted to make sure that each spread had its own life and its own characteristics. So hopefully that's mission accomplished.
Being Gary Fisher and the Bicycle Revolution is published by Blue Train Publishing, and it's £36. You can buy a copy direct from the publishers at
bluetrainpublishing.com. And as a listener to the bike show, you will qualify for a special discount. Well, a free postage, I think, is what Guy has offered us, which is tremendous. And I have to say, you know, £36, it's, you know, it's in coffee table territory for books, but it's absolutely worth it. Full colour on every page. A brilliant story told in a most wonderfully engaging way. And I will put a link to the website with everything you need to qualify for the free postage promotion if you're a UK purchaser on the Bike Show website. Thank you, gentlemen, both. Enjoy the rest of your days. And thank you for the time to come on the Bike Show to talk about being Gary Fisher.
Thanks
very much. It's been good therapy.